Welcome, everyone, to another Baseball America podcast, a special Memorial Day edition with John Manuel and Aaron Fitt. And Aaron, I'm going to tell you, I'm going to have to try to make up for it in person with the energy for not having you here. We've had some memorable podcasts on Memorial Day's past, and we hope to make this one a memorable one, whether you download it at iTunes or at baseballamerica.com. We thank you for joining us. And Aaron, 64-team field announced. Get fired up! It's NCAA, the road to Omaha. It's finally here. I'm very excited.
It's very exciting, John. This is always one of the most exciting days of the year. And I'll tell you, I suspect the tone of this podcast will be much more in line with the tone of last year's podcast than the very memorable podcast we did 2 years ago on Memorial Day.
I believe that J.J. Cooper actually is going to link to the 2009 podcast because he said he's lamenting the fact that we won't be screaming and making loud noises at the committee this year. But the reason for that is this was basically the quick way for me to put this for the John Manuel historians out there, and I'm sure there are many of you. This is like a Dick Rockwell committee this year. Yeah. This was like the first 2 years of the 64-team field where you finish in your conference mattered, and finishing second in a solid conference was better and rewarded more than finishing 8th or 9th or 10th in a power conference. I mean, that's the quick version, is it not, Aaron, of what happened this year?
That's it, and it's such a striking change from 2 years ago and 3 years ago, certainly, where you had, especially in the Big 12, you had the 8th and 9th place teams in the Big 12 getting in. Rhode Island, and I look at back at Rhode Island in 2009, that team finished 57 in the RPI. St. John's right now is number 54. St. John's probably has fewer quality wins than Rhode Island had that year. And LSU probably has a better case now than Oklahoma State and Baylor had in 2009. And yet, those teams got in, LSU did not. It's really a striking reversal for this committee.
It's a big reversal. There's no doubt about it. Aaron, my sense is we just got off the conference call. I don't think Tim Weiser agreed with St. John's getting in and LSU not being in. And my sense was he was on the losing side of that debate.
And that happens. I mean, hey, there's been plenty of times I've had to go to the top 25 chat, John, after losing a debate and defend something I didn't agree with. And, reading between the lines, I think you're probably right about that. I think, and I'm going to throw this out there because – 2 years ago, 3 years ago, in Larry Templeton's last year as the committee chairman, we speculated that perhaps, some politicking was involved with some of the teams that he had connections to doing well. And then the year after that, the Big 12 does well, and the Big 12 committee is on the chairman. St. John's gets in, and is it their AD or their associate AD? They've got a representative on the committee. I mean, it just has to be said.
Has to be said. No, you're right. That's a huge part of it. There's no other way to put it. That is the politics of the politics. And we've heard about a lot of backroom deals that have been made in the past. And, there's a lot of things that you see and you hear and you can't talk about a report because you don't have it confirmed. But, no, I agree with you. That had to be a factor. I don't think it's unfair to speculate that had to be a factor. I think that basically it speaks well of Tim Weiser as a committee chairman that if he came out on the losing side, that he allowed the other side of the debate to be heard and to be heard enough that it won the day. I think that speaks well of Tim Weiser as a committee chairman. And in the history of the committee since 1999, anything before the 64-team field is kind of irrelevant. But I thought Dick Rockwell was a great chairman. I didn't think so highly of Larry Templeton. At all. Tim Weiser has grown in my esteem just for the fact that their reasoning today with the 64-team field I thought was consistent. You could agree with it or you could disagree with it, but they were consistent. Where you finished at a conference mattered and RPI mattered less. I personally, Aaron, am on that side. I think that's a positive change for the future, but Tim Weiser was also very, very quick to say, don't call this a precedent. If you call this a precedent, you're reaching, he said in response to the UCLA. What did you think of that aspect?
It's interesting. It reinforces the fact that this is a year-by-year process, and different committees have different approaches. And certainly this committee emphasizes the RPI a lot less. We have become accustomed to the RPI weighing very heavily in these debates and conference standings not weighing heavily. And as we've written about quite a bit this year,
right.
You know, kind of looking back at some of these recent fields, it didn't really matter if you made your conference tournament. And with this committee, it did matter. And in general, I do like that. I really do. And you know that that I'm a St. John's apologist in general. I love Coach Blankmeyer. I love that coaching staff. I love Northern baseball. I think that they get underrepresented a lot because the RPI works against them. And, you know, it's not easy for St. John's playing in New York City to put together an RPI in the low to mid 50s. So I don't really have a major problem with them getting in. But all that said, I am surprised by it. I don't know if I would have put them in over LSU.
Right.
LSU, you know, they played a lot more good teams. They beat a lot more good teams, even though they also lost to a lot more good teams. It's tough. I mean, it's tough to make that case for St. John's over LSU, given the tools that are at the committee's disposal.
I'll tell you what the case against LSU. LSU's case four is that they're in the SEC and they swept Fullerton, right?
Largely. I mean, they also...
And they swept Wake Forest, which, you know, had a good RPI and, frankly, had a little bit better season, I think, than anyone thought they would have in the ACC.
Yeah, and you know, LSU also, at the end of the year, they finished strong against the lousy teams, and they won two out of three at Mississippi State, which they
right.
needed to...
Now, that, see, there, I would argue LSU should have gotten in over Mississippi State. That's a different discussion than LSU over St. John's, for me.
Yeah.
But if you're comparing them to St. John's, I would say, which is... I think, really, if you're in the committee room... Which is more impressive, St. John's in February going to Georgia Tech and winning one out of three, or LSU in March playing at home against Cal State Fullerton and sweeping that series? That's a really tough call. It's not apples and apples. It's apples
That's
and
right.
oranges with a Northern team going to Georgia Tech and playing early in the season. And winning a game in that series for St. John's, that's immense. I think that those are a push, even though – LSU swept a very good Cal State Fullerton team. I think those are a push. And if LSU had just won the series 2 out of 3 against Fullerton and St. John's goes to Georgia Tech and wins 1 out of 3, almost that's more impressive for St. John's to not get swept. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, I see what you're saying, but I don't agree with you.
Okay.
I think that's going overboard. I mean,
okay.
I think sweeping, you know, one of the, you know, a top 10 team, a team that's been a top 10 team most of the year, it's still, I don't care what the circumstances are, it's still more impressive than winning 1 out of 3.
Okay, I think I think when you take it into – and I respect that. I just think the Northern team going on the road to win a game against a top 25 team and not get swept in a weekend series, I think that's a huge deal. And obviously, again, that comes from the first couple of years on this beat, just talking to Dick Rockwell and talking to – you've talked with all the Northern coaches and about how tough that is. I do respect the fact that if you're going to say, hey, look, if you're going to schedule the games, win the games. You know, I respect that too. I thought it was very pointed – that Tim Weiser specifically said they weren't too impressed by the fact that 6 of LSU's conference wins were against Tennessee and Kentucky. And
right.
I thought that was a worthwhile point. I think LSU deserved to get into the field. I think for me, it would have come at the expense of either Dallas Baptist or Mississippi State. At Dallas Baptist, he pointed to the flaw in my mind in Dallas Baptist's case, which is, yeah, they have those good wins, but that's when they tilt the board in their favor and start their number one in midweek games. It sounded like that argument had been made against the Patriots repeatedly.
Yeah, that's right, and it's kind of surprising, you know, that he would mention that.
Right.
Even though, you know, and they're still in. I mean, that's a good point. I had Dallas Baptist in as my last team. I think St. John's wasn't even.
Oh, we lost you there for a second, Aaron.
I didn't think they had a chance. I was very surprised by that. Yeah, I mean, Dallas Baptist I had in as my last team into the field, John.
Yeah.
You know, so I'm not surprised that they're in, but St. John's is a surprise. You know, I just think that when it comes down to it, like I said, I don't have any major problems with this. I lost my train of thought. I'm kind of rambling
here. Dallas Baptist versus St. John's, basically. Or Dallas Baptist versus LSU, I guess.
Yeah, so I mean, you know, it's not egregious either way for me, but I do like LSU's case. I don't love it, and I'm not going to, I'm not going to feel indignant about a team that went 13-17 in its league not getting in. I don't think that team has a right to get in. I do think it's striking that Weiser specifically emphasized weekend series, which I hadn't heard them do before.
I loved that he heard that. It's almost when he said that, I almost thought, man, Aaron, you made a difference on the committee, because who else keeps up with that but us?
Yeah, and he talked about that's a big reason Arkansas wasn't a host, is they only won 4 of their 10 conference series. You know, that's something that matters to us, and we thought it didn't matter to the committee, and much to my surprise and frankly pleasure, it does. I mean, you know, should Arkansas have hosted over to UCLA? Maybe. But, you know, again, I'm not going to get indignant over that one when you only won 4 of your 10 conference series.
Right.
I mean, come on.
Yeah, there's no way to get indignant over that. And here's another one that was a bombshell in that discussion. I thought it was a bombshell anyway, Aaron. When Tim Weiser, the committee chairman, says that they don't see, the committee does not see the financial packages for the regional host bids. Because I got to tell you, the biggest problem I have with UCLA hosting is that Jackie Robinson Stadium is not up to snuff to host.
Right.
I mean, that's the problem. On the field, you win the Pac-10, you should host. I think that almost 100% of the time, it would have to be an extreme example of a team that was just awful non-conference. You know, you have to go to extremes for that to happen where I would not agree with it. But UCLA winning the Pac-10 and playing as strongly as they did down the stretch, I thought deserved to be a regional host. But Jackie Robinson Stadium is not up to regional snuff. Isn't it a 1,200-seat facility?
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, but then he said that the committee does not see the financial bids when they decide on the hosts. And then in a follow-up question, he said that had only been the case. He didn't know how long, maybe 5 years, he said. And I believe it was Dennis Pope who in the background said, oh, about 3 or 4 years. So, I mean, that is a recent development that the NCAA has never made public. I guess they know whenever asked. So thank goodness that Steve Pivovar asked, you know, the first question about Creighton, and then we were able to follow up. Aaron, that's a bombshell to me. And that is a big move in the right direction, I believe, for the committee, because they should make these decisions based on merit if you're going to really try to have the best championship you can have. Do you agree with that, or do you think Arkansas should have hosted because Bomb Stadium is really, in my mind, the best showplace in college baseball and probably the best atmosphere in college baseball is Bomb Stadium with 10,000 people?
You know, it's interesting to me because they always talk every year. You know, when we get to the Omaha for the State of Baseball press conference that they have with all the power brokers up there on the dais, they're going to talk about how much money this tournament makes. You know, and they talk about it at the ABCA convention, the Division I baseball meeting, how profitable this tournament is. And, you know, I think it speaks well. I think it speaks very well of this committee that clearly the NCAA values making money. You know, I think we all know that.
Yeah.
And yet it constructs this field with UCLA as a host over Arkansas, with St. John's in the field over LSU, which I'm pretty sure it would travel a little bit better than the Johnnies.
Yeah.
It tells me that this committee has integrity, you know, that they're trying to put together the best field, you know, for competitive purposes. And that, you know, again, I mean, the shift away from the SEC power brokers to me was just striking. And this is also a year where you can't cry if you're on the West Coast. For once, maybe we won't have to listen to all that. You know, I mean, the West Coast was very well represented. It had 6 teams in from the Pac-10, all 6 that deserved to be in. I don't think Oregon deserved to be in, although it got itself onto the bubble by sweeping Oregon State. You've got 4 hosts out there when really, you know, UCLA was a borderline host that none of us really expected to host. You know, the West did well this year, and none of those Western regionals are faced against each other. So if I have to hear anybody complain about the funneling effect.
Yeah, what a joke. I'm sorry, but that is a joke.
Yeah,
I can't stand the funneling effect. Because the thing is, I used to buy it because I heard it so much. I used to buy it. But how about all the teams in the Southeast, the ACC and SEC teams that play each other all the time in super regional? Like Clemson and South Carolina aren't tired of each other. Like North Carolina and South Carolina didn't get tired of each other. Like Florida State used to get tired of Auburn. I mean, it happens everywhere. Wear it, West Coast. I completely agree with you. Glad we don't have to hear about that. You put it very well. I know I interrupted you a little bit there, Aaron, but we have several podcast questions. podcast@baseballamerica.com. Let's take a couple of those. Bill up in Montana, one of our steadiest listeners. Guys, with offense down this year, is an extreme offensive team or extreme run prevention team more likely to surprise in a regional as a lower seed? Who profiles that way for each of us? I guess, Aaron, the first team that I would think of would be Creighton.
Yeah.
Creighton is an extreme run prevention team. And I forget where the Blue Jays get sent. They're a two seed, correct?
They're at Corvallis, which is very interesting because I think they're constructed similarly to Oregon State. You know, I think those teams, I think Oregon State's probably more of a high test version of Creighton. Those teams have similar styles for sure.
That would be the team I would pick would be Creighton, just because they're not going to beat themselves. Oregon State certainly. Obviously they don't have Darwin Barney anymore. That guy's in the big leagues, and I don't know if Carter Bell's the Canadian Darwin Barney or not. We'll really find out in this postseason whether he has that little extra something, that little extra moxie that Darwin Barney brought to Oregon State. I think he was the factor. As good as their whole team was, I'm not trying to slight any of the other Beavers from 06-07. To me, Darwin Barney was the difference. He was a difference maker. He was the best 300, 350, 400 college player there ever was. Who's a team like that fits that template for you, Aaron? A extreme pitching or run prevention team that you think is going to do better than maybe people might think?
Well, Charlotte. You know, I mean, Charlotte is built that way. They've got a great ERA. I mean, I don't see them going to Tempe and winning a regional against Arizona State and Arkansas, but you know, but that's a tough assignment. But you know, that's a team that's built that way. Maybe could surprise you. Maybe they pull off an upset against Arkansas in that first round. I don't know. The other side of the coin, you know, one of those teams that's more of an offense team. How about Central Florida going to Tallahassee? Kind of a high-powered offensive club in an offensive park. Just something to think about. I mean, there are multiple ways, I believe, with these bats. There's no one winning formula, or at least I don't know it, because we've seen some teams this year that are built like Creighton with pitching and defense really do well with these bats, and we've seen some teams that are built like Central Florida and are, you know, power bats still and power arms. That's their whole deal there.
Central Florida's a pretty interesting team. That's a good call, Fitzy. That's a really good call. I like that. That could get interesting. A couple other calls on our podcast, not calls, a couple of podcast questions via email. Well, Bill said the committee not peeking at regional bid financials is a huge step forward for college baseball, correct? And we obviously agree with that. David K. Lee saying, is there any reason? So he likes the philosophy of the change away from conference finish now being more important than RPI. Was any reason given for the change of philosophy, and will this last? Sounds like, Aaron, the reason was different composition of the committee, different committee members who valued committee conference finish more than RPI. Was that your takeaway?
Yeah, I think so. I think that's it exactly, and I don't think it's necessarily going to be, an annual thing here. I don't know that this is going to be a long-term shift, but I also have to wonder if perhaps some of the negative backlash that the first Tim Weiser committee felt. If that played a role, because, you know, we all blasted those guys bad. If you look back to 2009, listen to that podcast, you'll know. And we weren't the only ones.
Yeah.
You know, we weren't the only ones. And you know, Tim acknowledged it. He knows what people were saying about him. You know, I talked to him about it afterward, and he kind of shook his head, and he took it well. I mean, give the guy credit. But I think he was receptive to that, because last year's field was a lot better and a lot different. And this year's field, they've really continued that shift away from teams that didn't do well in their conference but still had good RPIs.
I just think that's a huge positive for college baseball. Aaron, Johnny Glenn, College World Series season ticket holder, asks, what factors does the committee use in deciding where to put teams such as Creighton and Illinois? And I guess the thing is, the first thing is geography, but the second part really seems to be they do have they line up their 16-1 seeds, then their 16-2 seeds, then their 16-3 seeds, and really kind of try to put that puzzle together. Were you surprised by any of the placements? It seemed, Aaron, that the placements this year, there were some non-traditional ones, and geography didn't. It was very difficult. I think they had a really tough time with all the hot conference hosts being five ACC hosts, a bunch in Texas, and then several in the West.
Yeah, you're right. I think it's a much more interesting, unusual field than usual. It's just, you've got some teams going places where maybe they don't usually go. You know, nice to see East Carolina going to Charlottesville instead of back to Chapel Hill, for instance. I had expected the Pirates to be in Chapel Hill, and Florida International was the team I sent to Charlottesville. That ended up being reversed. I think that's good for a little bit of variety. You know, I thought looking at the Atlanta Regional, that one jumped out to me a little bit. You didn't have Southern there. Instead, you had Austin Peay as your four seed. I thought for sure Austin Peay would be sent to Nashville. Geographically, that would make sense because I also thought Belmont could sneak a three seed. But instead, they gave Belmont a four seed in Nashville. They sent Austin Peay to Atlanta, which pushed Georgia Southern up to, Clemson, I think.
Yeah.
Columbia, excuse me.
Columbia, so, you're right.
So, you know, you had some teams that were in different spots a little bit. You know, instead of Georgia going to Georgia Tech, Georgia gets sent to Corvallis, and you know you've got Southern Miss and Mississippi State going to Atlanta. So, you know, I think it's it makes for some new matchups. I think it's welcome. You know, there's some traditional ones as well. You know, you've once again you've got TCU and Oklahoma, that feels familiar. You've got Baylor and Rice, that feels familiar. You know, there are certainly some ones that you can't avoid. But on the whole, I like this feel. I really do.
I agree with you. It's the Baseball America podcast with John and Aaron. Now, Aaron, I don't know if we're going to have time to go crazy with our regional previews in the future, the rest of this week. Are you going to have time for that? Am I going to have time?
We can make that happen, I'm sure.
Okay, well, we have to make that happen. That might have to be a nighttime podcast. But let's real quick just go over. We talked about some of the more interesting regionals. Which ones did you think were – I got this question on Twitter a lot. I'm sure you have already. Which is the toughest regional for you? I thought that I thought that it's almost like a consensus that Texas is regional is the easiest one. Did you agree with that?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I thought Texas State was a soft number two seed, given their records against the top 25 and the top 50. I thought they would be a three. You know, I had them as a bubble team going into the weekend. Kent State as a three is fine. They should be a three, but I don't think they're one of the stronger threes. So, yeah, I think that's a fairly soft regional.
If Kent State had any success in regionals in recent years, I feel better about them. Like I said, they're three. They are where they deserve to be, but they haven't really like made a lot of noise in regionals. I didn't think there was a regional of group of death anywhere on the 64 team field.
Right.
I do think Clemson's regional is tough. I think those top three teams are stout. I thought Coastal would be a two. They get into the three. I understand why they're a three. I mean, they could have been a two. They've certainly been hot. They won their conference regular season and tournament again, and they're an experienced club that won a regional last year. To me, that's a good regional with Clemson, UConn with their talent, and then Coastal Carolina. Which one stood out for you?
And I had Coastal as a three, but to me, you know, I actually had UConn as a three also just because of the RPI. So, again, we've got the Big East getting more credit here, you know, while the SEC got less credit. But I think that's also a testament to the fact that UConn is loaded. And you know, give the committee credit. They apparently know that UConn is loaded. Weiser even acknowledged it on the committee that he thinks it's a very good UConn team. So even though their, you know, their numbers, their records against the top 50 or 25 maybe aren't special, UConn gets the benefit of the doubt despite a great RPI, just an okay RPI.
Right.
But I'm with you. I think that's a tough regional. I mean, because I think UConn is a really talented, dangerous number two seed. You know, we've got them, 15 or 17 in our top 25 right now.
Yeah, 17 or 18, somewhere in there.
So we like UConn and Coastal. But, you know, it helps Clemson probably that you're going to have a Barnes-Mayo showdown in that first game.
Right.
Clemson won't see either one of those guys in game two. That sets up well for Clemson, I think.
I agree. I thought Florida's regional was also pretty strong. Miami certainly, I think of a different ACC season. And if Miami maybe – if the ACC didn't already have five hosts, Miami had a case to host. You know, they won three out of four games against North Carolina. That's basically the best thing Miami did this year. But Miami is a two, and obviously Florida and Miami have some history. Jacksonville, I think, is a very solid three, and Manhattan is a four. That you know, they've made some noise in regionals. Obviously, Chris Cody's not walking through that door, and neither is your friend and mine, Nick Durba. But but Manhattan, yeah, that's a pretty steady MAAC program. They're a four seed, but either a four seed that if you don't play well, it's capable of winning a game.
To me, this regional is a place where the committee maybe missed an opportunity for some diversity. You know, rather than have Florida and Miami play each other again, which it seems like they do all the time, I thought you know you had a lot of two seed options in Florida. I figured with the Gators being a high national seed, the number two national seed. I had Stetson. And I thought maybe UCF could go there. I mean, I didn't think you'd get Miami as a fairly strong two seed, considering those teams have played each other all the time in the postseason. But so that was one surprise. I mean, it's fine. I don't think that's particularly unfair to either one of those teams. But it's a little surprising considering you had other two options there.
It seems like that was the problem for that was that, you know, if you sent them somewhere else, you can't send them to Florida State, obviously, because they're in the same league. If you send them, say, to South Carolina, where Stetson was, then where do you do with NC State? Because NC State's the three seed. You can't have Miami and NC State. You might have had to, like, say send NC State up to some other regional, maybe move St. John's as a three to South Carolina. It would have been a pretty big puzzle. It seems like that's why Miami was there. But I agree with you. They did have an opportunity missed there as far as a some diversity. Mm-hmm. Was there another regional field that stands out to you, Aaron?
I will say that I really agree with your assessment that there is no one regional of death or whatever that seems like there has been every year. I think that's great. I mean, these are balanced regionals that are, not overly loaded. Mostly I just think that they're strong. They're well constructed. I think the Tempe regional, you know, as we touched on, I think Arizona State and Arkansas, it's a really strong 1-2. New Mexico is obviously one of the weaker four seeds as a 20-39 team. But that's, you know, I thought Arkansas would probably wind up elsewhere, UCLA or Corvallis, one of those, you know, probably softer one seeds. I mean, I have to imagine Arizona State was not far from the national seed discussion. I'm surprised they got the two seed that I thought was probably the strongest two seed, the one that would have been my team number 17 to host. So that was a little bit of a surprise, but again, not a huge deal.
I agree. Aaron, let's also wrap up the podcast here real quick by talking a little bit about the tournaments that we both saw. I wasn't at the finals of the ACC tournament. You were at the SEC tournament. Obviously the biggest story, it seems like, of the SEC tournament was Georgia. Spirited run for a team that's gone through a lot the last couple of years. And with two players being paralyzed in the last 2 years, which is more than you ever wish on anybody. But a spirited run by the Bulldogs to go 3-2. They had to finish above 500 to get an at-large bid, and they just barely did it. And they did it in some style, beating some good teams like South Carolina and Florida. It was a Florida they beat once, right?
That's right. They beat South Carolina in the second elimination game. They were blown out by Vanderbilt in the first game. They looked terrible doing it. They looked disinterested, and it was embarrassing for them. Even Perno said so. And they responded from that by beating Auburn in a game where both teams were playing with urgency because the loser's season was over. And then they beat South Carolina, you know, a very good South Carolina team, obviously. And then they beat Florida. So, I mean, that's an impressive run. I mean, Coach Perno said afterward, you know, he wanted his team not to just be the sympathy team. He wanted them to be the team that people respected. And, boy, they sure have that. It's hard. I mean, everyone roots for those guys because of what they've had to endure. But it's hard not to respect them, too. I mean, what a resilient bunch. What a lot of heart that team has.
Yeah, and meanwhile, on the flip side, I'm not saying they're a heartless team, but, tough break for Auburn. Which really, I know that they went 0-2 in the SEC tournament, and that sealed their fate. But really what sealed Auburn's fate was not winning the series against Tennessee to finish the season.
Yeah.
Almost feels like Auburn might not have gotten a bid, even though their RPI was pretty high, with the lack of respect shown to LSU didn't get any credit for three wins against Tennessee. What would Auburn have gotten if they had won? Maybe say they'd won that Georgia game. But coming off of losing a series at Tennessee, would they have been left out of the field? I mean, you kind of got to wonder. It's a moot point now, but, I mean, Auburn, they really fouled the bed, as Jim Callis likes to say, by losing that series at Tennessee, right?
Absolutely right, and they really gave it away, too. I mean, they were in position. I think they had a ninth-inning lead in one of those games, at least. I mean, they really – it's the story of their season. I mean,
they just
had a lot of missed opportunities, a lot of blown leads, a lot of close games that were winnable and that turned into losses.
That's absolutely the story of their season is bullpen. The bullpen just did it to Auburn all season. Aaron, in the ACC tournament, any surprise to you from afar that it came down to Florida State and Virginia again, kind of how that league has come down to all year?
Yeah, you know, those two teams won their respective divisions, although Georgia Tech tied Virginia for the lead there. But Yeah, I mean, those teams seem like they're just good tournament teams, whatever reason. The last two, was it last year they played each other too?
I think it was 2 years ago.
It was 2 years ago. No surprise. No, I wouldn't say so. I mean, I think that I love what Mike Martin said about his team afterwards. Did you see that quote in Teddy Cahill's blog from Mike Martin about describing his team's character? He just said, they're just so daggum tough. they don't give you anything, and that's what they are. I mean, they're men. That's what he said. They're men.
Nice.
And that's what they are. They play above their talent. They're really well coached and scrappy, and not surprised that they made that run. I mean, you only had to go 2-1 to reach the championship game in that league with the pool play format.
That is a pretty whacked out format and a conference tournament that probably means less than any of the other conference tournaments from the big conferences. To me, I just cannot believe that that's still a format that exists. It is what it is. Aaron, Bill Lamberty also asks at podcast@baseballamerica.com, are either of us stressed out, not to mention bummed out about the new stadium as he is? They showed the new stadium on the 64-team field selection show on ESPN, and Kyle Peterson said, it's got all the amenities. It sure is nice. But I think we're both, there's some trepidation on going back to the College World Series without the stadium on the hill. We talked about it before that, but it's going to be a different series. There's no doubt about it with the bats. It's a very clear demarcation. There was an era in college baseball from 1999 to 2010 that was an era of growth, offense, 64-team field, upsets. You had teams from power conferences. The West had a nice run there. Then the SEC finishes it with back-to-back championships. And now 2011 going forward, we're in uncharted waters. We're in a completely new era of college baseball defined by the bats on the new ballpark, I feel.
You nailed it, John. I love how you put that. I think you're exactly right. This is a new world. And I don't know what is going to be the successful formula in the postseason because, like I said, you still got to be able to score runs. I mean, you can have the best pitching staff in the world. I mean, Cole and Bauer are awesome. Might be two of the top three picks in the draft, but if you can't score runs for those guys, UCLA has 22 losses this year. I mean,
yeah, that's amazing. That is amazing. That is
so. I just think that we don't know the answer. We don't know what's going to succeed. We don't know how the new ballpark's going to play. We suspect it's going to be more pitcher friendly, and especially with these bats the way they are. But it's going to be fascinating.
You really think about that. UCLA has had 30 games this year started by Colin Bauer. They only have 33 wins. I mean, I don't know, they didn't win every game those two guys started, but you would think coming into the year, if those two guys started 30 games, you would expect that team to win 25 of those.
And they've got a potential freshman of the year candidate on Sundays with Adam Plutko. I mean, their pitching is really, really good.
It is as good as it was advertised to be, Aaron.
But their bats have come on down the stretch, and that's why they're number one seed hosting a regional. They won the Pac-10, they went to Arizona State, and they hit. So give them credit for that.
Who's been the key to that? I mean, obviously they weren't in a conference tournament, Aaron. What bats have come on for UCLA? Because last year, they relied a lot on Gallego, and then who was the second baseman who got hurt? Ramatoula.
Tyler Ramatoula.
And he hasn't been a factor this year, wasn't he? Isn't he suspended, or there's something going on with Tyler Ramatoula that I keep forgetting?
Academically ineligible.
That's it.
They missed him. I think he was their three-hole hitter for most of the year last year. But that was a blow, certainly. Dean Espy has come on strong. He's kind of the most dangerous guy in that lineup. I guess Cody Regis as well. But it's not an intimidating lineup. But it's better than it was earlier in the year. I mean, they're hitting .264 as a team. They have 16 homers. I mean, it's not scary. But they've got to execute. That's all.
I just think you look at their stats and you see that Garrett Cole, among the pitchers on their team who've thrown more than 18 innings, has the worst ERA on that team. I mean, it is amazing. And last thing, Aaron, we're getting ready for the postseason. It's awards time. Let's talk about some of our finalists. We don't have official finalists here, but player of the year, freshman of the year, coach of the year. Obviously, teams that make big postseason runs are going to factor into our coach of the year discussion. But player of the year, Aaron, it's the year of the pitcher. I think it's appropriate that it seems like the two best cases for player of the year are Trevor Bauer of UCLA and Taylor Youngman of Texas, whose numbers are just otherworldly.
It depends, you know, how much you like the strikeouts, first of all. I mean, Bauer's case, he's a lot more strikeouts than Youngman. He's got 8 consecutive complete games, which is nice. You know, I mean, his ERA is not far off from Youngman. He's 12-2, but Youngman does, you know, Youngman's 13-0. He leads the nation in both wins and ERA. He's got an ERA below 1, which is nice.
Unbelievable.
You know, and he's also Taylor Youngman is the number one pitcher for an elite team, whereas UCLA hasn't really played at that level. So I think that matters as well. But I mean, it's tough. I think Bauer has been more traditionally dominant. I mean, he's got 189 strikeouts. That's amazing. But Youngman has been just as dominant in his own way with his efficiency, and you know, he doesn't have the strikeouts. He doesn't need to strike people out to win. So I think it's a great race, and I think CJ Cron would be my third guy in the mix if you want a hitter. He's had an amazing season for Utah, but it looks like that season is now over.
That is amazing that he's had the kind of year that he's had, and Utah played a good schedule. I mean, for a Mountain West team, UCLA played Utah played a very challenging schedule, and of course Utah going to the Pac-10, but played a Mountain West schedule this year, but they really kind of ramped up, it felt like, for going into the Pac-10 with that schedule. Freshman of the year, and you mentioned Adam Plutko, Colin Moran, just having seen him up close and personal for North Carolina, what he means. I think if we had a most valuable freshman, Colin Moran would be on that short list for sure. Who are some of the other freshmen who are in that mix for freshman of the year nationally?
Yeah, Moran might be the front runner, but it's close. I think that one's pretty wide open. Carson Whitson at Florida, I think, has got to be in the mix. Tony Kemp at Vanderbilt was the SEC freshman of the year. He really makes that team go. Chris Bryant at San Diego has had a huge year, kind of under the radar because their team hasn't been very good. But he's lived up to the hype that accompanied him down to USD. So, you know, those are some of the names, that, I guess, that jump out to me for the freshman of the year conversation.
And our coach of the year, you know, South Carolina and Virginia were not. Well, South Carolina was 7. Ray Tanner's our reigning coach of the year. It'd be hard to see a guy getting back-to-back awards when there are other real worthy candidates, but I think we both think that Ray Tanner has done a pretty amazing job this year. Virginia has lost 9 times all year. They weren't even in our preseason top 10. I think Virginia's season certainly seems like it puts you know, Brian O'Connor on that short list. And you know, who else in your mind is in that mix for National Coach of the Year?
Well, I think you hit the guys that come to mind first. I mean, I think O'Connor and Tanner, and like you said, it's probably, let's face it, it's probably not going to be Tanner just because we don't usually do that back-to-back years, but his coaching job has been amazing. Certainly deserving for me of the SEC Coach of the Year. You know, I think that Mike Martin is a guy that has never won an award that probably needs to factor into the mix because he, you know, this team is, it takes after him. You know, I just think that it's not an overly talented team, but they win a lot of games and they're a national seed. I think that's pretty impressive.
It's a team with 3 pitchers they trust, Aaron. I mean, yeah. Sean Gilmartin, Daniel Bennett out of the bullpen, and Mike McGee in whichever role they use him in. And that's it. Everybody else out there is a giant dice roll.
Right.
That to me, and then they have, you know, offensively, there's no Buster Posey or Tyler Holt carrying this offense. It's a good offense. But it's not even a vintage Florida State offense. It doesn't feel like it anyway.
No, you're right. I mean, I just think that that's a great coaching job. I mean, that team has played above itself a little bit, and that's what it does almost every year. That's why Florida State is so consistent. And the other name I'll throw out there is Pat Casey. You know, they stumbled down the stretch. You can throw Tim Esme in the mix as well because Arizona State has had to go through a lot, you know, to be where they are.
No doubt.
They've had some serious distractions and tragedy with the Corey Hahn situation, of course. But both those two guys, despite the way they finished the last 2 weeks, I think those guys are in the mix as well.
I agree. And the best thing about it is that for us, these awards don't come out until Omaha. So we've got another weekend to evaluate. And what happens in the postseason? 2 weeks, I should say. And what happens in the postseason matters. And you're not going to have, you know, somebody lifting up our National Player of the Year trophy like Dirk Nowitzki a couple years ago in the NBA, and their team goes home in the first round of the postseason. I mean, that could happen. That could happen with some of these, obviously, freshmen or Player of the Year, or CJ Cron, like you said, whose season's already over. But we've got, I think, more time to evaluate. And what happens in the postseason does matter, and it should matter. So Yeah. I like the fact that we wait on our awards as opposed to sending out a third team, All-America team that has 60 guys on it and make sure we get it out by regionals.
So, right, exactly.
Always prefer that. Aaron, the other best part, I guess, of UCLA being a regional host is that you'll be there. So what are your postseason plans the first weekend or two?
Yeah, I'm going to juggle back and forth, I guess, between UCLA and Fullerton, both of which are, you know, easily drivable for me. And it's nice to have that variety. I think that the UCLA regional with Fresno and Irvine and San Francisco, it's pretty solid. You know, I mean, it's not overly compelling, but it's fairly compelling. Certainly Fullerton and Stanford, I mean, that's always fun. It's a great rivalry. Those teams have gone head to head quite a few times in the postseason, and I think Stanford's a very exciting young team. And then you've got Kansas State and Illinois as kind of the colder weather grinder kind of programs, you know, that that don't have the talent of Fullerton and Stanford, but they play hard. And this is Kansas State's third straight regional. That is amazing to me. They've never been to a regional in the history of the program, and then they've now gone to three straight. Brad Hill and that coaching staff, just a tremendous job. And same for Dan Hartlib at Illinois, you know, a program that has flown under the radar, a team that has flown under the radar all season.
They were never in our Big 12. We didn't seem like they were in our Big 10 discussions all year. We talked about Michigan State. They had a really nice season. We talked about, don't forget Minnesota. But it didn't seem like Illinois was really in the consciousness, at least for me, they weren't.
Even Purdue, Indiana,
right.
Penn State. I mean, all those teams I even talked about more than Illinois. Illinois snuck up on me, at least, I'll admit it. They've got some athleticism, they've got some veterans, and they're well coached. That should be an interesting team to look at.
Really, what I know about that team is Willie Argo. I mean, their number one starter from a couple years ago, Phil Hague, who won a game at LSU, he's now in the weekend rotation for Florida International. He's a transfer.
Yeah.
So that's a guy that's a guy they might have been counting on, although he might be a fifth-year senior by now. But, I mean, Illinois doesn't always get the benefit of the doubt, and, you know, it would be a nice year. You could maybe look at 2011 as a significant year for Illinois if they – not only, obviously, they're going to regionals, but what if they hold on to Charlie Tilson in the draft, a guy who's a possible first-round, second-round talent? What if he ends up going to school? It could be a big year for Illinois.
And how about this? What if what if they're the dark horse and they steal Serrano away from Fullerton? You know, they did it once before to the Titans. Come on.
Yeah, I'm not feeling that one. You open that up. I'm going to keep on talking college baseball. I'm just – the tournament, we were going to break down all the regionals in a podcast later this week. But, I mean, we were so nonplussed by the tournament field in a way. I mean, not nonplussed. We just – there weren't any shocks. We talked about the surprises already. I'm going to ask you about a couple coaching stuff here, Aaron. Tennis – no, you don't have to dish rumors, but, I mean – you mentioned Brad Hill at Kansas State. Why would a Tennessee or UC Santa Barbara's not a huge job that's open. Why would a team in a BCS league that's hiring a coach not look at Brad Hill at Kansas State? He, to me, is the under-the-radar best candidate to hire. If I'm Tennessee and I'm not bringing in Brad Hill, I'm doing a disservice. Aren't you? Because that guy's track record, national championship at the Division II level, and he's taken Kansas State – he's gone where no one has gone before.
He does an amazing job. He really does. And, I have to imagine that Nebraska would love to get him. I'm not sure that he would leave for Nebraska.
Why did I forget Nebraska? Yeah, great point.
Now that they're in the Big Ten, I mean, I don't know why, if you're Brad Hill, why do you leave the Big 12 for the Big Ten?
I'll give you 330,000 reasons.
There you go. That's the answer. that's the answer. But
I mean, Nebraska, there's a lot of speculation about Nebraska. I thought it was fascinating, Aaron, that you posted, I thought, really reasonable names for the Nebraska job. And the Nebraska fan reaction seemed to be, that's it? That's the best we can do? I thought that, throwing out some of the names you did, like coaches at Illinois State and Kent State, or Southern Illinois, I should say, Mark Kingston.
Illinois State.
I was right the first time. Scott Strickland. You know, guys who are successful coaches at mid-majors, I thought that was very reasonable for a Big Ten job. And, the Nebraska fans didn't seem to want to hear that.
Yeah, Nebraska's a program that's been to Omaha in the last decade.
Three or four times.
So, yeah, they obviously have high expectations for their program. And, if I'm Nebraska, I'm very happy with Brad Hill for sure, or Scott Strickland or Mark Kingston or, even Rob Fornasier, like I threw out there.
I love that idea.
I don't know. I don't know what direction they're going to go. That one should be interesting to watch.
The Brad Hill idea just makes even more sense. And I'm sorry we're speculating with Brad Hill's career and life here. But I mean, Central Missouri was a pretty good spot for Nebraska last time when they went and hired Dave Van Horn from there. That worked
out.
That's
a great point.
That worked out well for them, and Brad Hill succeeded Dave Van Horn. But that'd be pretty good. If you ask me, what Brad Hill's done at Kansas State is he's a miracle worker. So
he can get back on his mule and ride it back up there. We'll see.
Outstanding mule riders reference of the day. Aaron, I believe I will be over in Chapel Hill because I still have two kids and I'm still coaching T-ball. So I doubt that I'll be going on the road. But we do expect to send a BA staffer, most likely Jimmer Schoenard, down to Columbia. They'll roll out the garnet carpet for Jimmer down there in Columbia. So we'll have all kinds of regional coverage. Our regional podcast will come up later this week. Fun podcast, Aaron, a lot less outrage this year than 2 years ago. I almost missed the outrage days.
Yeah, you know, and that's a credit to this committee. Like I said, I think they've grown. I like Tim Weiser personally, and I think he's done a much better job these last 2 years as the committee chairman. He's grown into it. He's grown into a very solid chairman.
I agree, and this is a fun time of year. Love it, and love talking draft. Love talking 64-team field. We'll do it again later this week. We'll break down all 16 four-team regionals on an upcoming podcast spectacular here at BaseballAmerica.com. For Aaron Fitt, I'm John Manuel. We'll see you next time on the Baseball America podcast. So long, everybody.